So we're just going to move on. Our speaker, Anita Collins, is here. I learned just a little, Emily knows her pretty well, but I did learn that she got an undergraduate at Penn State, and then she went to The Ohio State University to study bees primarily, and then made a career, a 20-year, at least a 20-year career of 30-year career of doing that. And so she's got a good background to help us understand this, and then we'll have a period of time for some questions. So, Anita,
okay.
Thank you for being here.
Sure. A little bit more background on me. I worked for the U.S. Department of Agriculture and was initially involved with getting all the data on killer bees from Venezuela. And but my part of the thing didn't work at all. I was trying to breed gentler bees, starting with killer bees, and it didn't work. So by that time, we were already going in other directions. And the other directions helped the beekeepers keep their queens from mating with Africanized drones if they were queen rearers, because the queens mate in flight. And so that seems to have worked. We've had very little problems with them in the US. I think there was one death, but that was it. So this is sort of a combination talk, okay? So let's go to the first slide. Okay.
Yeah.
My experience is primarily with honeybees. And they sort of got dropped out of the rest of the presentation because they came from Europe with the settlers. Mm-hmm. And the Indians refer to them as the white man's fly. And they like North America, so they spread. And so we have honeybees in North America. Okay? That's a honeybee. And beekeepers and some colonies. Okay.
Oh, next slide. Sorry.
Yeah.
We're still trying to figure out how to work this thing.
Okay. The honeybees are really important for agriculture. 4 million for honey, 18 billion in terms of crops they pollinate. The important part of this is that they are generalists. And so they'll go to pretty much any plant where they can get nectar. Mm-hmm. Now, some flowers, they can't figure it out, but by and large, they do almost anything. Okay. They're also a very highly social insect. They build big colonies. That happens to be a open air colony, not in somebody's hive. And that's a queen. So you can see they're rather larger than the workers. And most beekeepers put some kind of mark on them so they're easier to find.
Interesting.
model dope works really well.
So that white thing is a mark on that bee. It's like,
yes, oh, it's a paint mark on the forearms. Yeah. Now, for those of us who have to know which queen is different, I have glue on numbers.
Wow.
A little round thing that's colored and has a number on it. And so the Europeans have given us a lot of good tools to work with.
How big is that colony? Like, is it like this big or
this colony over here? If you broke it down, it's probably one white super worth of bees. Maybe a little bit more. But that's typical. They've got some of the comb horizontal and some of it vertical. They kind of do what they want if they don't have a nice box building. Okay. So what bees do you know?
Swift.
Yeah.
Swift bees.
Yeah. Carpenter bees, okay.
Bumblebees.
Bumblebees, okay. You can put up the next list.
Larvae.
The larger class of bees includes bumblebees, carpenter bees, squash bees, wool gatherer bees, leaf cutter bees.
Are those all North American bees left?
These are all North American natives.
Natives.
Yes. And there's a whole bunch more that have no common name.
So what did the plants, the agriculture do for pollination before the Europeans introduced honeybees?
These guys. And these guys tend to be specialists on one or a group of related plants.
So polyester bees, how do they
line their nests with some secretion, and we've named it polyester.
Okay.
So it's so it's waterproof.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
go ahead. It's waterproof.
It's waterproofing because the eggs can't be touched by water. They can't fly in water. So
we have no idea how many species of native bees we lost with the introduction of the honeybee. That's impossible to know.
I'm guessing from what I know from other places that we might have lost about a third of them, and there's a bunch more of no common names. So New York, they've done some surveys recently, and there's almost 400 native species in New York. Pennsylvania doesn't have
species.
There's
a pollinator survey you can find on the DEC website.
Pennsylvania has slightly less because we have probably less ecological regions than you guys do. You go more north to south than we do. So I was involved with doing some volunteer work for survey.
Not your nature instinct.
No, it wasn't. Yeah. No, it wasn't. It was, sorry, the brain doesn't work as well as it used to. But it was one of the other federal agencies who are responsible for surveys of, it's the National Geographic Survey. They were also surveying bees. So some summers ago, I did some surveying for them around Eastern Pennsylvania. And we had a native bee person kind of combining all of those and setting up a web page of some sort. I haven't looked at it in a while, so I'm not sure. But
so out of the listed species, are any of them capable of producing honey?
No, these are not honey producing bees. There are several species of honeybee in other parts of the world, in addition to Apis mellifera. But the native bees are not honey producers. Okay. About 4,000 in North America. That's an educated guess. 80 species in 65 genera in the East. You can read that. I didn't find 400 in Pennsylvania. It was closer to 300. Yeah. But I didn't do all of Pennsylvania. But I want to point out to you this. One of the things about bees is they have long tongues, they are hairy, and the hair is kind of fluffy and captures pollen. So you'll notice this bee has all of her pollen on the bottom of her abdomen. So they have different places they carry their pollen, but the hair is what's used in the process of their going over flowers to pick it up.
So she doesn't put that there. She just picks it up in the course of a business.
Well, she probably combs some out of the rest of the hair.
I didn't get to.
Okay. But probably a lot of it is just looking at what kind of flowers she's on. Probably a lot of it is self-deposited.
Ready?
Okay. Most native bees are solitary. The bumblebees, and there are a number of species of them, are the only social native bee, but they have relatively small colonies compared to a honeybee colony, you know, some hundreds maybe, and they nest in the ground. So if you run over them with a lawnmower, you'll realize they're there. Okay. Most of them don't sting. That's a honeybee on the pin showing the stinger. But most of these don't, they're not very defensive because they don't have much to defend. They've not got honey stores. They don't have large numbers of pupae, which are protein for some things. So they're pretty much, it's a mated queen who digs a nest and lays eggs and provisions them. And I'll show you some of that. If there's a lot of bees around, it's because the ground is suitable for that type of bee. And so they're all nesting in that corner, not because they're social. Okay? All kinds of habitats. And the native bees tend to be in sync with the flowers they pollinate. So they're coming out at different times of year. Some of them only live a few weeks. Some of them live maybe a month or so. But it's not like honeybees where there's somebody in the colony all year. So they're there and gone after they lay their and provision their eggs. And they have habitat and plant preferences. No, that's fine. The adults you see are usually mated females. That happens to be a pair that's mating at the moment. That's a drone on the back of the female, and I don't know which species it is. I'm sorry. And they don't have huge numbers of drones like honeybees do, because obviously those two aren't mating in flight. So. And honeybee queens have a pheromone. And when they fly, the drones are usually hanging around waiting for somebody to go by. And whoever can follows her, and whoever can get at her mates with her. So she normally mates with, say, 25 males or something. So she's, so a colony gives you genetic diversity, which is a good thing. So, okay.
Wait, so are all female fertile? They're all of the native bees there?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think they're like honeybees where they have colony with mostly workers that are unfertile females. Yes.
And then they're in a cocoon or in, so they go somewhere and just hang out as a cocoon or whatever.
They go through that one summer, and then the queens mate, and then they go to what we call a hibernaculum. They find some kind of protected place where they overwinter.
But they don't like follow the same flowers north or anything. They have a small range.
They're pretty localized.
Yeah.
Okay. And all bees collect nectar. They have long tongues. They collect pollen from flowers. They're hairy, so that. And there's a bunch of parasites that are like cuckoo birds. They lay eggs in somebody else's nest and let her feed them. And those ladies are not hairy because they don't need to collect pollen from them. The pollen's the protein source, and the nectar is the carbohydrates. They build nests in a number of different places. A lot of them are wood borers. Basically, they bore a straight long hole with some side holes, and that's all they've got. Some of them use stems like raspberry canes, and they clear out the cane and then lay eggs and feed them in there. And a whole slew of them are ground nesters. And they raise the young to a certain point. Okay? It's not like a colony where somebody's always feeding young bees and taking care of newly hatched eggs and that sort of thing. So they've got a small batch of young, and we go on, I'll tell you some more about that.
Yes.
Okay, this is the long tongues, and I put this particular picture in. That happens to be a, no, it isn't a honeybee. It's somebody else. Coppolicans, something or other. But you'll notice that her tongue has three lobes to it.
Mm-hmm.
And she uses those to kind of sop up everything where she's getting nectar. Mm-hmm. And she sucks it up through the central column.
Are these your photographs?
No.
Oh, terrific.
I'm not an insect photographer, I'm afraid.
Great.
So I've picked these from a number of different places. And a lot of them are like this green thing here in the bottom left. They're that bright metallic green. Yeah. I don't know what's about that color, but there's a whole slew of them that turn out to be that color. And the other one's a bumblebee. And they have sort of thicker tongues. So, okay. Okay, bees are hairy. And you see they've got hair in different places. Honeybees have hairy eyeballs.
Oh my gosh.
I don't think they usually get pollen on their eyeballs, but they do right around the eye. And then they sit there and comb it out, and then they pack it in pellets on their hind legs. And I'll show you the structure they pack it in.
So that hair actually comes right out of their eyeball. That's
crazy. Oh yes.
Oh my goodness.
That's one of the ways you can tell it's a honeybee.
Okay.
Apparently.
Huh. Wow.
But you see there's hair on legs, there's hair on the bottom of the abdomen, just the thorax in some cases. Mm. All kinds of different ways. Okay. Here are some of the parasitic species. They tend to be rather interesting looking. We had a number of the nomada, which is the yellow and red one, in eastern Pennsylvania. So I saw a number of those. But I'm not sure who the other two are, but they're typical. And some of them have this real pointy abdomen on them,
mm-hmm.
which means they're probably laying a smaller number of eggs. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that for sure.
So are they bees or are they...
Oh, they are bees. They are all parasitic. Bees.
Yeah.
But they're parasitic, so they're hairless, more like a wasp is.
Yeah,
but they're not a wasp because you don't see the really skinny waist. That's one of the things.
The one on the right. I mean, I would have to see the difference between that and an actual wasp.
Yeah, the wasps has a much more narrow, definitive waist.
Wow.
Between the abdomen and the thorax.
So, are those stinger bees? Do they have stingers? Do you know?
I think they do. But they don't use them much.
Because
they don't have a lot to defend. Because a honeybee colony's got all that honey and young brood and stuff. So it's a good source of food for all kinds of things. So they use their stingers repeatedly. Okay.
How does stinging?
These guys nest in the soil, and they make some of them make pretty elaborate entrances. Mm-hmm. they stick the soil together with secretions from their mandible glands, and some of them just push it out. And if you look at, particularly like one of those on the middle, it looks like the left diagram, where there's a fairly long nest, and then she starts making side chambers. So she's not laying large numbers of young, large numbers of eggs.
They're pretty pretty her lobe there.
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. Some of them do this nesting in tool, in tubes. The carpenter bees make their own tunnels, and they do cut the kind of same thing. If you look closely, that's a ball of pollen and nectar with a little tiny white egg on the top, all the way up.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's called. It'll come up on one of the slots somewhere. Honeybees are progressive provisioners, so they're constantly feeding them. And it's also mostly pollen and nectar.
Is it common to be the same as a borer bee?
It could be. I don't know the term borer. There are wood boring bees. There's a whole group of them, and the carpenter bees are one piece of that. So that could be the crossover world.
Okay. Those stems can be as small as, and that's amazing.
Yeah, that's like a raspberry.
Yeah,
that's a stem. But they have to have fairly stiff outer walls, fairly sturdy outer walls. Mm-hmm. And they then separate them with probably leaf particles.
Mm-hmm.
Leaf cutter bees make nice round cuts out of the leaves, but the rest of them just whatever. So, okay, this is honeybees. They're the progressive provisioners. So on the left, that's a honeycomb with newly hatched larvae. And initially they get some royal jelly, but unless they're trying to rear a queen, they don't feed them any more royal jelly. Then they switch to pollen and nectar. Queens get a really big cell and get nothing but royal jelly. They get big gobs of royal jelly on queen cell. And people harvest it and make cosmetic stuff out of it. It's supposed to be wonderful for your skin. Okay. The solitary bees are complete provisioners. So they are providing, here's this picture again of a tube, and she's collected pollen and nectar and made it into a little ball, and they all have their own recipes for how much nectar and how much pollen. And again, they do some separation between them, and then they lay an egg on top of that. And then they're gone.
I see. So they're
they're
giving them their food.
They're giving them the food, and then they're out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So the mated females don't hang around for anything. We've made artificial nesting sites out of all kinds of things, and for some native bees, like the alfalfa leafcutter bee, there are people who do nothing but raise alfalfa leafcutter bees and provide nesting for them. And then pack them away for the winter so they're protected and bring them out in the spring and they emerge. And then somebody buys a bucket full of pupae and sets it out in their alfalfa fields, and the bees go to work. Because honeybees don't pollinate alfalfa.
Oh, that's okay.
The flowers bop the bees in the head because of the way they're structured, and the honeybees don't like it. The alfalfa leaf cutter bees get around it somehow and don't get hit in the heads.
Did they Do they cut the leaves? I mean, they're probably leaf cutter, but do they?
That's where they collect the partitions. They cut perfect circles out of a leaf. And if you can find leaves with
They don't damage.
No, they don't. Yeah. They don't significantly damage the plants that they're taken from. They're usually fairly small circles, and there may be a bunch of them, but they're not the whole leaf.
So what is this guy doing?
It's kind of a piece of crap. Oh, the guy, not
the man.
Oh, those are.
What?
Cages or nest boxes
for
the native bees.
And these,
he's got native bees that have nested in there and left eggs and pupae behind. And then he'll rear them in an incubator or something and have native bees.
So the alfalfa leaf cutter bees, do they have companies like they have with the honeybees that travel across the countryside to provide pollination services?
No, they're not social. They may nest in an artificial nesting site or a place where they can build a nest, and you may have a whole bunch of them. I'm not sure what alfalfa leafcutter bees like nesting, but there's some bees who like sandy soil, other bees that like more clayey soil, that kind of thing. So, and sometimes you'll find, you know, maybe a patch of soil about yay big, and there's a slew of native bees nesting in it because it's just the right stuff. So people can be surprised by who nests in their backyard. Mm-hmm. There's a wide range of sizes. Xylocopa virginicus is what? Brain is going numb. It's one of the big bees. Maybe one of the big bumblebees. And then there's a whole slew of these mid-sized metallic green things, and some of them have black and white abdomens, and some of them, you know, they have all variations in color. And then this one on the lower right here, Perdita, is the smallest species, and I've tried to make that correct relative to each other. So they're really tiny bees. Pardon? That's a carpenter bee, she says. She looked it up on her phone. Good girl, thank you.
Nice.
I was going to say that, but I wasn't 100% sure. Okay. They've been around for a long time because we have all kinds of preserved specimens in amber where they got stuck in the sap from the tree they were nesting in or something. And so they co-evolved with their specific plant group. So they have rather different characteristics outside of the fact that they tend to have long tongues and are hairy. Okay. But we've got all kinds of old-fashioned bees preserved in amber. Some of them have been made into jewelry too. I think I have one, as a matter of fact. Orchid bees are specialists on orchids. So you only find them pretty much in Central America and a little bit to the north and the south. But you see, those are green. Now here are some squash bees. They have a very different shape. They have very kind of squished abdomens. So they can get in around that flower, but they're still hairy, and they still have long tongues, so they qualify as bees. They even look like this. Okay. The big one is something called Anthophora, and the common name is blueberry bee. And particularly in the lower right picture, you see them hanging upside down, and they actually kind of shake the pollen off onto themselves. And they've got a long enough tongue to reach where the nectar is. So they're adapted for rather different flowers. Okay. This is a megachile. They tend to be on things like whatever the heck that is, you know, with a central anthers and then petals around it. And they're one of the groups that collects the pollen on the bottom of their abdomen.
So they are really not that bright yellow. That's the pollen.
That's the pollen. Right. Yes, that's the pollen. So it's like a tea. And the pollens tend to be anything from pale green or pale yellow up through dense yellow.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's even like orange or kind of brown. And so depending on the bee, you'll find different colors. Okay. This one is a morning glory specialist. There's a whole group here of these guys. And she's one of the ground nesters. Serotina, this is a small carpenter bee. So they're digging a tunnel into some kind of wood, probably smaller branches, and rearing their young in there. And they come in kind of different sizes and shapes. They're kind of cute, I think. And this picture is typical of a bee's abdomens. They have these dimples in them, especially if they're not hairy.
Oh,
the lower
that's
right.
The abdomen.
That's, excuse me, the thorax.
Okay.
That's the thorax. I'm tripping over my own words. Mm-hmm. And that pattern of whatever's on the thorax is one of the ways we do identification.
Oh, my God.
Wait, so that's like with that super magnification.
So yeah. That's a scanning mark on my perspective.
That's, yeah.
I expect.
Yeah.
I expect. Mm-hmm. Because you don't see quite that detail under a dissecting scope. But you see enough to say, okay, it's covered with dimples or it has a couple of central bare spaces or whatever.
Mm.
So these are all bumblebees. Again, they got a lot of hair. And they go crawling around on the top of the anthers and long tongues that go after the nectar.
Do they always have, well, they're always hairy, never, but why do they call them bumblebees?
I don't know. Somebody who first identified one said they were bumbling around and buzzing or something, and it stuck. And these are the only, I think I said this before, the only native bee that's really colonial, but they have relatively small colonies and they have their own set of bumblebee parasites that are hairless. So I can't read what's under the picture of the eye. Oh no, never mind. That's a, from like a honeybee, and it's, could you read the words?
Corbicula?
Yeah. Corbiculus. And you see that it's kind of dish-shaped. That's one of the parts of the hind leg. And then it's got those spurs on the outside. Mm-hmm. So they pack the pollen into that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they carry around these pollen pellets rather than all over their hair. The bumblebees, I think they do it, some of them do it a little bit, but it's really common in the honeybees. And you'll find little pellets of pollen laying outside an entrance of a column as it gets knocked off and they're going in and out. Okay. They do poop,
yeah,
but it's flat.
and about the same color. There's a whole group of larger bees called Melisodes. They're not bumblebees. You see the long antennae on them. That's one of the characteristics of it. And they tend to pollinate fall composites. So they've got some really long combs. And they're like honeybees. They suck it up and they store it in a honey stomach. Which is what they call it in honeybees. I don't know if they have a different name in native bees. And then they regurgitate for their young. Okay. Or in the case of honeybees, they're regurgitating it into the wax. And then they get air currents going in the colony and dry it out. So it thickens up in the honey. Okay. These are some of them don't have colonies. And these you tell apart by the pattern of hairs on the abdomen. They're fairly small bees. You can tell by the size of the insect. And there's just a whole group of them that are hard to tell apart. Okay, what was this?
This looks like your survey.
Oh, that was my survey. Yeah. And they're color coded to the names on the transects on each side. Mm-hmm. And there's some that have very few bees.
Mm-hmm.
And it might have been just due to what particular season that was in, but they had ended their season, so the mated females were gone, so I wasn't catching them.
So what is the light blue? Is that the power tower?
Yeah, that was a power line. So there's all kinds of mixed flowers in there, so you get all kinds of different stuff. So you get a lot of bees out there.
And then they go in spraying with herbicides.
Yeah.
Well, the bad news is this new class of neonicotinoids is really hard on bees.
Just banned them in New York.
Yeah. Good for New York.
Yeah.
Good for New York.
Because
a honeybee colony can spare a few. But the native bees are really even more impacted by it. So if a lot of more other states don't continue to ban the neonicotinoids, we're going to lose a lot of native species.
Mm-hmm. So, and that when we lose them, we also lose native plants that depend on them.
Absolutely.
Because
most of the native bees are specialists on a group of plants. And so if you don't have them, you don't have the plant.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then biodiversity.
There's 27 species of known non-native bees, and somewhere in the middle of putting this talk together, our bee guy told me that we just found a new one. And most of them nest in wood or plant stems. What did I mean? We're not sure about what impact they have on natives.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some studies that people have done on native bees in an area where there's a lot of honeybees. And there's some competition, but it doesn't block out all the native bees. Because the honeybees can be territorial.
So they would chase other natives away.
They could give the natives diseases too. If they were carrying, the non-natives can bring diseases to, like the honeybees could.
Well, the honeybees have spread varroa mites to some of the native species. Because that's become a big problem in honeybees.
Yeah.
So yes, there is diseasing.
I'm not sure. It seems to me, I've heard also that honeybees have spread some variety of foul brood to other species. That's something that kills the pupal stage.
Mm.
And I think there's been some spread of that to other native species. Mm. Okay, this is one we happened to find in our survey, and it was about the size of a honeybee, but it wasn't a honeybee. It had nice white eyes and some other differences. This is a recent carpenter bee introduction from somewhere.
Well, coming on wood.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Absolutely.
Well, pallets have to be treated with heat treated or treated with choline. But it could come in imported wood for construction.
Yeah. This is the Nature Center where I volunteered, Lehigh Gap, Pennsylvania, on the Lehigh River. And we planted extensive amounts of native planting just to provide habitat.
Yeah.
This was, in fact, a Superfund site.
Ooh,
they used to mine zinc here.
Wow.
But the layer of zinc was small enough that we got a bunch of these native plants to take hold and spread.
Nice.
So it was, the planting itself was quite impressive. So just some other, this is some of the small common bees that, you know, they look like, kind of like honeybees, but different colors and smaller. The Andrena are usually small bees, but some of them are hairy and some of them are the hairless parasites. And then they get some coloration on the cuticle and you get all kinds of stuff. Makes them fun to identify. And I was not real good at it.
Oh. I mean, looking at the veins.
That's why I got somebody else's pictures.
The veins. Oh my God.
Yeah. Okay.
Your last slide.
Thanks for listening.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. So, no, the honeybee is not a native. They came over with the settlers.
Yeah.
The colonists very early on.
Yeah.
Started bringing colonies with them.
Yep.
And
what we're going to do is have, because we started late, this went a little longer than I expected. And that's okay. That's fine. So we do need some time for questions, but we'll keep it to 5, 7, 8 minutes. So anybody with any specific questions?
So when you did that survey, how do you find them?
You trap them.
Oh, you trap them.
Yes, you put out little bowls in plastic cups that are sprayed with the right color blue, and you put sugar syrup in, 50% sugar syrup. And you wind up with some combination of stuff, including some wasps that are syrup collectors, nectar collectors. And there are some wasps that do make honey.
Interesting.
Interestingly called honey wasps.
They're native.
And they're native. I think they're native. Yes.
To here.
Yes. To North America. Yeah.
So if they're not, so if you do a survey, but they're like early bees, you won't find everything if you just do a survey once a year.
Yeah, you do it across the summer. I was doing it. Every 3 weeks or something. Because a 2 or 3 week window is usually enough to catch a female.
So is there any way for us to, like, I mean, there's food and then there's the habitat. I mean, where to help them have food, but also shelter?
I don't know that much about the habitat other than that they're primarily ground nesters.
Yeah, so it would be.
So it depends on what kind of ground they have. So.
But also, not cutting things like raspberry canes.
Yeah.
So that they can, they're not really depending on the live.
No, depending.
the
dead
plants. Yeah, so probably didn't cut it, but might not.
Later season beans. Mm-hmm. So if you let them stand for a while, once you start get freezing weather, it's too late.
And then do they have a 1-year life cycle, or do they go and form a cocoon? I mean, what do they come back as the same?
Well, it depends on the species. The majority of the bees are queens reared and mated one summer, and then they overwinter in a protected area. And then build a nest the next summer. And then they're gone. Because they're not taking care of the division. Incomplete provisioning.
So how do we know if it's a wasp? Oh, you said those skinny waist things are called?
If you know what a honeybee looks like, bees look like bees,
mm-hmm.
and wasps look like wasps. They're more slender. They tend to have pointy abdomens.
Mm-hmm.
Bees have mm-hmm. blunt abdomens.
I see.
They're just—it's just a real different visual.
Oh, I'm sure I've been calling wasp bees.
That I know how many species there are.
You indicated that most of these are not social. The native bees.
Yeah, except bumblebees.
Are they defensive? Do they sting all of them?
Well, you see, they're this a provision. They completely provision their young. And then the queens leave. The queens are gone.
Right.
Because there's nobody taking care of the young. They got to feed themselves. They provide the ball of pollen and nectar. And then the young hatch and consume what of it they're hungry for. And then they spin a cocoon and come out as an adult. So they're the queens for the following year.
So the squash bee, which I see all the time in my squash flowers, do they sting? I don't mess with them normally, so I don't have first-hand experience with them. But
if you picked them up and held them in your hand or something, they would probably sting them.
I'll mess with them.
But
no, I don't mess with them. I'm looking for more.
They're not defensive in the sense that a honeybee or bumblebee colony is, where if you if you go over a bumblebee colony with a lawnmower, you got bees mm-hmm. following you and stinging you. You know, or you do something to a, I said bumblebee, I meant bumblebees.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and if you have a honeybee colony and you throw rocks at it, you'll get a response.
Yeah.
And if they're Africanized bees, it'll be 10 times as bad.
But I've had experience with bumblebees singularly.
Yeah.
I grabbed a goldenrod and I never saw the bee, but the center of my hand knew it really quickly.
Yeah.
Bumblebees to me were always something that I enjoyed watching flying around, but I never grabbed one.
Yes.
Bad experience with other bees.
Yes.
But
you get the message.
Yeah, rather quickly.
Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is everybody aware of the Hudson Valley Pollinator Guide that's come out?
Yes. Pollinatehv.org. Okay. The website. Yeah. And you know about that?
Yeah.
Great.
I've been sent a couple of copies at the time.
Anita just came out.
Anita helped the CAC write a letter in support of the Neonic Bike Ban. But it didn't get passed.
It did?
Yeah.
I don't know when it takes effect.
Anyway, we need to be moving
that's
on,
my
guys.
Understanding
we'll be here forever. We don't want to do that.
Yeah, I think that's
right. We have enough people here now to actually we've achieved the quorum, believe it or not. And so can I have a motion, assuming that you all read the minutes that Neil put out, can I have a motion to approve those minutes?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Any additions, changes, anything? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Europa, you're on.
Sure. I'll try to keep it brief.
Okay.
First of all, apologies for the mishap. It looks like most folks have made it tonight. And Simon, thank you for jumping in. We called down the list. We're going to send around the contact list just to the core group of EMC members after to try to get everybody's updated cell phone numbers, especially if you're willing to share. Just let me know separately if you don't want this list to go around and want to keep your cell phone number and your email to yourself.
One comment. She just showed me something on her phone.
Uh-huh.
The neonicotinoids, there's a group of them that are used as seed treatments, and
mm-hmm.
they're equally as bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
On the seeds. Yes.
Yeah.
But hopefully not in New York, although they might come in on the seeds, I guess.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So anyway, we'll get that sorted. We're going to try to get the SUNY room back, but I think we have to do it semester by semester. So that's what happened. The semester just ended. We didn't get the memo. So we need to re-book the SUNY room. So it may change. There could be a chance we have that, you know, stopgap measure of doing the meetings here. It's very intimate, but we're all friends here. So we'll make it work and we'll keep everybody posted. I did want to run it by you, Davis, Chair. We were discussing having the annual CAC's Environmental Boards Roundtable in August again, in lieu of the EMC meeting, providing you're willing and able and, to seed the meeting for that month.
And mm-hmm. in addition to that, we usually have 1 month during the summer we do not meet. That would be July. Okay.
Oh,
maybe. And we'll meet in June.
Okay.
We'll meeting in July and the joint meeting with the department.
Okay.
August me.
Great. Thank you. We have a plan for the summer then. And then the other thing I just wanted to mention, I think a lot, everyone received the invitations to the Community Climate Action mm-hmm. Plan focus group. So I have a couple flyers for those. We have one tomorrow night in Kingston that I'll be at with my colleague Michelle Glock and some other Ulster County folks from other departments. And the one in Milton is tonight. So we're all here, not down there. And then, of course, there was the battery energy storage webinar as well. So tonight was a very busy night for us at Ulster County Government. And then next Tuesday from 5:30 to 6:30 p.m., we're having the last focus group in Ellenville. So we're really trying to cast a wide net. This is kind of early stakeholder engagement. Again, we're trying to extend beyond the preaching or picking the minds of the choir, right? We're trying to do broader stakeholder engagement. So we actually, although we let everyone here know, and we let a lot of other key partners, stakeholder organizations and things like that, we're going to engage them in other ways throughout the project. So we're really trying to get more like actual members of the public and community leaders and people like that and representatives of organizations. So we're doing the best we can. Fingers crossed, we did our homework and we have good attendance. So the other thing on the Community Climate Action Plan is that we're thinking we're going to combine the roundtable event, kind of just structure it as one piece, maybe an hour and a half is kind of a workshop with this group and maybe a more broader group of stakeholders. From similar kind of realms to focus on the Community Climate Action Plan prioritization of the strategies, you know, the greenhouse gas emissions reduction actions that we kind of have identified, at least to some extent by that point. So we're just thinking maybe it'll be, say, a 3-hour event, an hour and a half will be this workshop with invited broader audience. have our nice food break. And then maybe the second part will just be more the traditional roundtable, nice updates from everyone. So we'll discuss it further, maybe at the July meeting, let you know where we're at. And then last thing on the Community Climate Action Plan, I think I've mentioned to this group before, as part of that project, we contracted with ICLEI, Local Governments for Sustainability. So they developed a community greenhouse gas emissions inventory for the county. We also know the Hudson Valley Regional Council recently did those as well. So it's actually great. It's complimentary, but it is slightly duplicative, I'll admit it. They just got it done quicker. It was a race to the end. But we're also excited because ICLEI is providing community profiles. So it's basically local, town, city, village level greenhouse gas emissions inventory, starting with the county one, breaking it down to the local government level so that everyone can kind of pick those up. And the goal is, we can't guarantee it, but the goal is that they're aligned with the Climate Smart Communities Program action and will ultimately meet the requirements of those actions if the municipality, you know, wants to take it on, use it. Because again, that could be a huge project for a small town or village to get these, you know, collect all the data to try to figure out their community greenhouse gas emissions. And I really see the value of doing things like that at the county or the regional or even statewide level. So when we have those done, we'll send you out the information, and then and there's kind of a template. It'll be also in a Word document that folks can pick up and customize further, you know, for your community. So yes, we're excited about that. Let's see, the only other things I'll just mention briefly are the Arbor Day applications. I think we got something like 5 applications. So don't submit any more applications. Once we have a chance to review and we're at the other end of these focus groups and the stakeholder engagement for the Community Climate Action Plan, we'll sit down, start reviewing them, and contact folks if we need more information, and start scheduling site visits. So thank you all for applying. It's always good to have more interest rather than less. And then the last thing, and I'm sure there's other projects I'm missing out on, the Lower Esopus, we're putting the finishing touches on the public website with the final draft implementation plan. So again, when that's up, we'll send a note out to the folks here, so you have a link to that. And then again, reminder, the natural resources inventory, that mapper is on our website, and I'll try to remember to include that link in the email, because I really think this is a core group of end users for that natural resources inventory. So we want to keep reminding you it exists. There's a municipal toolkit. There's a checklist that includes different layers you might want to include in site plan review and things like that. So reminder, it's there. Questions, comments?
Can you also indicate what the pesticide waiver committee did?
Yes. Okay. So just briefly, the county has a law, the non-toxic pest management law, bans herbicide, pesticide, and herbicide applications on county-owned or leased properties. Well, county-managed properties, I should say. So for years, the Catskill Mountain Railroad has been applying for an annual waiver. Most years, it's been granted a limited waiver, right? It's a one-time waiver, usually for biannual spraying, pre- and post-emergent. And then Ulster County staff, you know, they notify when their spraying happens. There's certain parameters, you know, it's I think a 20 foot wide from the center line of the rail diameter, right? 10 feet on each side. Yes. Certain sections near the farm hub and other areas are restricted. It's totally prohibited. And this year, for the first year in several, the committee actually rejected the waiver application just for several reasons. We don't have time to get into, but just so everyone knows, in case you hear about that, that we did not grant the waiver. We, the committee, with several representatives, including Bill represents the EMC.
And I represent EMC.
Yeah.
In the meetings that take place. And yes, I voted not to allow the waiver.
All right. Vicki?
I'm up. Okay. I'm going to make this really quick, although there's a lot here to report on from the energy, environment, and sustainability meeting. They had 2 meetings in April. They reported on the first one, and the last one was the 30th, and they don't have one until next week. There were 3 resolutions on the agenda. One was withdrawn. They had a resolution that passed to provide funding to replenish funding for the Ulster County Solar and EV Charging Infrastructure Program. They also had a resolution that was passed to replenish the Ulster County Brownfields Program. UFRA, Mark Ryder, the executive, did a report to the committee and you know, he basically reported on that, you know, they have some vacancies that they're they want to fill. One is the recycling enforcement officer, also a coordinator for organizational performance and development, and then they also are looking for an agency council, and I believe they're actually doing some interviews for the council. And he also supplied a report for the number of tonnage of each category of waste they collect. And it's amazing the amount of different categories of waste they collect. They even have, they not only have the compost, you know, that they do, but they also do deer composting, which is completely separate. You know, the deer gets hit, you know, and then they pick up and just food. And then they had a lot of discussion on diversion. When haulers dump their municipal waste on the tipping floor, staff go through it by hand and they recover fluorescent light bulbs, freon containing appliances, organic food waste that's still unpackaged. And then I talked about the animal composting. There was also talk about partnering with the Chamber of Commerce to divert their food waste and recyclables from their breakfast and other events, and also they want to do some improvement on the diversion at the Ulster County Fair. The hazardous waste events, that's on the website, okay? They already have one, and they had it April 26th in Newport. They had 300 appointments and 250 shows, which is basically normal. The next event is June 23rd at the town of Ulster Transfer Station from 8 to 12 noon and by appointment only. The Renewable Energy Implementation Program. There has been a team appointed, which, you know, they've been appointed for a while. Trainings are provided to municipalities, for example, solar mapping training that I attended and that many of you probably have too. 100 people have taken the home map, right? And Manager was working on a report of who in each municipality has taken it and whether they've done a report. Then there was a presentation by the Mid-Hudson Valley Energy Transition. This is a organization that's located in Kingston on Wall Street, and it's a nonprofit organization, and they work around assisting disadvantaged community, assessing the ability to transition their homes to renewables. And I gave the contact information to Dave so that maybe she can do a presentation to us. Burley is doing a zero waste program, and they entered into contract with Greenway for a 3-month pilot program to divert 9% of their organic waste from their municipal waste. The cost is $20,000, and I believe the county is going to help find out that half of it at least. There is public comment to the Public Service Commission opposing changes to the NYSERDA Clean Energy Communities Program. Manager was really concerned about this because it's changed, that they're changing the programs and it's now just catching on. Castile Mountain Railroad has now switched to 100% biodiesel fuel, and they are doing air quality monitoring. They are working with the Department of Public Works, and also Manager mentioned that there's federal money available for solar power railroad.
My father was steam engine.
Our cars could be solar powered by just putting solar on the roof, you know, and then, you know, but anyway. A member of the committee visited a 24-hour recycling center. And it was in Virginia, I believe, and it was fully staffed. And very effective, because a lot of people don't have time to always just do the recycling during the day. So, but anyway, Newport has bins that are available from the set. And then there was the thing called the Rabbit Act. Does everybody know what the Rabbit Act is?
Okay.
You told us last time, but I forgot.
Okay. The committee wants to do a memorialization for the resolution, or, you know, federalized resolution, but it was tabled for the next meeting. Now, this act is in response to the state meeting. The state meeting is renewable energy goals. It's called the Renewable Action Through Project Interconnection and Deployment Act. It proposes to streamline the environmental review and permitting of major renewable energy generation and electric transmission facilities. It would centralize the efforts within the Office of Renewable Energy Sitings within the Department of Public Works, as this is state. This is meant to create a one-stop shop for committing these projects. It also transfers the jurisdiction over to the siting of electric transmission facilities from the Public Service Commission to the Office of Renewable Energy Sitings. And that's my report.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate that.
Is would
so,
be minute person like
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you. That was
I'll give it to you every month, okay?
Yes.
Just so you know, I am moving along with the proposition that we will host the NYSEC conference next year. I've got another two outside groups that are willing to work with us or co-host with us, whichever. So I'm working with that assumption. Okay. We know more about that at this time. Oops. I think we're at the thing. Yes. So we'll do relatively quick roundabouts this time. But we'll start with you, Bill. Anything in particular?
As you large here? I passed out a flyer about household hazardous waste cleanup days. It's in circulation. We did miss announcing the first one, but there's more coming at various locations. There's three pages. They all are one flyer.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
But I thought at least passing it out, you would have the opportunity to see that information. Before I retired, I used to be the guy that checked with all the municipalities about things going to cleanup days, so it's still very near to my heart.
Mm-hmm.
They're successful. They take a whole lot of stuff out of who knows where. And the other thing on the flyer, there's an announcement about a paint recycling capability where you can make a phone call and make arrangements for them to come to your house and pick up all your old paint.
Really?
For recycling purposes.
Who picks it up?
It's listed on it. It's a company that's doing it. Hmm. I talked to one of their reps then in Poughkeepsie at the home show. They're willing to come to your house for very small amounts. And I went home and counted the number of cans I had. It's a whole lot better than sitting all afternoon at a kitty litter to paint cans. Having done that once in my life, it was too much.
Now, can you take paint? You can take up a paint can to the place where you bought it, right?
No. There is not a requirement for them to receive it back.
Really?
If you call them and ask, they may be good to you, but most of them do not.
No. But there is a paint care program, unless it went under.
Yeah.
And there are participating places.
Right.
And so, it's being replaced by this company. That's my understanding.
I don't see it. Wow, I can't believe they can make money. But it's still not, I'm sorry. When you say paint cans, make sure you understand there has to be paint in them. And that if there's no paint in your paint can, you can throw it away.
Yeah, if there's nothing in your paint can when you're finished painting,
it's an
empty container that comes out with your metal can recycling.
Yeah. They don't always like it.
You just have to rinse it out, right?
No.
Just let it dry.
You only want it dry.
Let it dry. Take the lid
off.
But
the other side of it is don't use your paint cans for other things without adequately putting labels on them, and don't put them out with your trash. Wait for the cleanup days. There's been too many instances of spills at the ends of driveways of unknown materials that bring out a full emergency response as it eats your driveway away. If you're going to mix things, always make sure you label it. The safety requirements across the board in your household start with labeling everything you got. But my effort was to get the information out about the household hazardous waste.
Still on.
Oh, thank you. Sorry.
We need to see each other at
this point. Yeah. Apologies.
Got to turn on the flash.
The only thing that I would add, and I just noticed this because I purchased some varnish of lately, and they're starting to require it to be water-based rather than oil-based.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
I'm still questioning whether, when I went to get the local hardware store and the Benjamin Moore stuff, and the only thing I could get was water-based for floors. That's all I could get.
And you can still buy marine varnish, though, right?
I'm guessing you can, but for my local little hardware store, that was it. Just so you know, I mean, which is good and bad. I'm not so sure it's as good a product, but nevertheless. Anyway, we need to, unless there's something else, we need to move on. Kristen?
Just quickly, our Hurley CAC is working on our natural resource inventory. That's like our main effort right now. And there's members of the CAC on the Comprehensive Plan Revision Committee. And they just sent out a survey to the town, asking questions about what the town wants. And it's online on the town website. And Climate Smart Communities, we are finishing up our clean energy community submissions so we can get our points and our grants, hopefully. And as was mentioned, there's a zero waste early project that just got kicked off. And the goal is to eventually have a town-wide composting, whether it be people composting in their backyards or encourage that as much as they can. But there will be drop-off locations, and they'll be able to drop off at the transfer station also. So it's starting off with this study. That's what the $10,000 is, half of the cost of this initial study. And they're looking for 20 families to sign up, and they're going to show them how to measure their waste and categorize it. So they're going to actually study what people put in the garbage. And it's also educational. So that just got started.
Jim?
Okay, Town of Rochester, our ECC, we are up to 6 members now. And we have another person interested, so we can have up to 9, so you might be able to send them some.
Did you say it's a CAC or an ECC?
Well, we're an ECC. Okay. Rochester.
Yeah.
Now, the town has formed a committee for drafting a community preservation plan. So that's going on, and they're actually looking at the inventory of properties we might be interested in acquiring, to preserve, their value. And more than half of the properties in the town. We have stream sides, et cetera, historic properties. Mm-hmm. So that's ongoing. They are trying to get the plan together and get this on the ballot for November.
Wow.
It's kind of a tight timeline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'll maybe do it next year, but we're hoping this year. And the last thing, we're planning our annual tire pull from the Rondell Creek. Oh, yeah. Basically, we're doing it June 15th, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. We got a series of canoes, kayaks, etc. Mm-hmm. We just sort of, it's very shallow there, about knee deep. We just pull the tires out and they get brought to the transfer station and they may be recycled. Our shop supervisor thinks that there's a way they can recycle some of the auto tires. I don't know. But that's June 15th.
Fine. Thank you, Bob. Simon?
Bob Cruikshank from the Shandaken CAC and I were part of the team that organized the air source heat pump and EV demonstration day at the Catskill Vista Center back on May 18th, which was very successful. Thank you, Bob.
Yes. Hi, everybody. Thank you, Simon.
That's good because that helps us towards our clean energy communities, because we get 5 EVs purchased and 5 air source heat pumps bought. That gives us $5,000 for each one once you've registered for that. And I think we've already achieved those targets. Talking clean energy communities, the town is going to buy air source heat pumps for the town meeting hall with our initial grant. And with the new grant, we're deliberating what to do with that.
SOP pump?
Air source heat pumps.
Air source.
Oh,
yeah. I know it's an SOS. That's all right.
That's it for me.
Thank you. Thank you. So Neil or Roberta Gardner?
Well, Roberta was just took a significant action to sample the water in the Shandamkill stream submit it to a lab to test for E. coli and ammonia and
phosphorus and coliform.
And we took this on because we're aware that the town of Bloomingburg upstream was having an issue with their sewage treatment plant. Mm-hmm. So they're dumping untreated sewage into the Shandaken. So we want to find out what's in our water downstream. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
So that has put me on this interesting thing interesting track. So Frank down there was saying, you know, you can get DEC alerts. And so I signed up for the alerts and it says that Kingston and Poughkeepsie, like I got two over the weekend, that they were both dumping raw sewage into the Hudson. And so I was wondering about that, like there's some legal, you know, stormwater, you know, waiver or something so I was wondering about that. And then I did hear from Frank down in Bloomingburg that they did somebody applied for a grant and they did get the arm fixed and they're working on fixing the filters, but it's not all the way done yet. But the real problem is one of the real problems is those disposable wipes that are clogging up the whole system.
Yes, we've heard that.
So yes. I wondered, like, as a county, like, would that be something interesting like that we did as like a unified group, like a countywide effort? Like, I can, if we want to talk about it next time or something, that, you know, if there's something like we all want to work on together.
A publicity thing, an educational thing.
It could be that or something else. I thought, you know, we should do like have a project that we do together.
That's a good idea. You mean getting rid of the wipes?
Just the quote unquote disposable wipes. But I mean, as a mother, you need those wipes. But
they know that just things
But you know, educating people, but also, you know, eliminating those disposable moniker somehow.
Yeah, I mentioned to him last week that maybe it's Bell Group that I used to work for New England Interstate Water Pollution Control Commission, and they have a lot of educational. I believe they still have a lot of educational information because they basically train wastewater treatment people and stuff. So you don't have to invent the. Reinvent the wheel. Can I cover the
stormwater? Tomorrow, the 30th, we're having anyone who's interested about the warehouse, Eric Clay meeting in Gardner Town Hall.
Can I explain the
what's the warehouse?
Yeah, I know.
giant warehouse proposed on in Modena, right on the border of Gardner on Route 4455, in the middle of nowhere, not like near a highway or an airport or anything. And so there are a huge amount of trucks. And so it's in the town of Plattekill, but Gardner is more active. So we're looking to have this meeting and get some more people, from Plattekill, but New Paltz, anyone in the neighboring towns that, this is going to affect all of those towns.
Sure.
The meeting tomorrow.
Yeah, this is a 10-acre warehouse with 78 truck bays. I mean, it's enormous.
Any particular reason why they've decided to site it there? Because, like you say, it's most of these things are
it's
10-acre
building. Nonsensical.
Years. And so he found these people that bought it, apparently, they bought the property, so they're not going to stop. Yeah, he sold it.
Is it the zone?
It's in a commercial zone, but the argument that it's not zoned for that.
It's an agricultural zone, right?
I think it's light industry.
Yeah.
So,
light industry. Covers a lot of ground.
Well, and the first thing that you want to be looking at is with 10 acres of coverage of a non permeable level, are they planning something for annual rainfall? Where's it going to go? Is in the proposal any discussion of that? You also want to add to that any areas of paved areas around the building. If it's 10 acres in size, you're going to have a notable number of employees.
Parking and truck access. No, there's wetlands there. I mean, it's a
So
what's tomorrow?
Moving
back. A rally or a planning board?
A gathering to organize action to.
Any newspaper. Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else from Gardner? I mean, that's big enough.
Yeah.
If they ever put it in, put solar on that 10 acres.
Seriously.
On its only roof.
Yeah.
Let's hope it doesn't happen. So, anyway. Emily, what you got?
But my turn?
Yeah, your turn. Is.
Okay. Okay, so I just want to say that our Common Council committee passed the community preservation. There were a bunch of resolutions. So I just want to say for us that we work backwards, and in order to get everything on the ballot, we have to have everything done by August, because it has to be go in front of the Common Council twice and all this stuff. So good luck on getting the ballot. They did do only 1.25% for the real estate transfer tax. But that did pass, so now there'll be some hearings, and they have to read it in Common Council, and then hopefully it'll get on there.
How does that apply to environmentally? I'm lost.
The community preservation.
This you said 1.25%
real estate transfer
the
tax.
Community preservation fund.
Okay.
Yeah.
How's this one?
I thought you.
I'm lost with the connection here.
Okay, so you pick up the community preservation program is where you plan, create a plan using your NRI and your open space. You find out all these things that you might want to protect by raising money, and then you raise the money through a real estate transfer tax, and the real estate transfer tax is 1.25% over the anything that sells over the median homeowner property price. Anyway, and I know also that there's something coming up, because right now, it's only Long Island, Westchester, and a couple of counties, and there's talk. I think NYSAC did that. I don't know. Anyway, they're trying to move it farther into the rest of the state. And we are still working on, we're just trying to get our
we're encouraging our DPW in our parks to phase out gas-powered lawn equipment, especially leaf blowers. But I wanted to point out that NYSERDA just came out with a guide to electric-powered lawn equipment, so you can, anyone can read it, it's for anyone. And then also there's a Clean Energy Communities. You can get whatever points if you convert over, but it's anyway. And I wanted to say, I'm gonna say one first. So the reason that there's raw sewage going into plants along the Hudson River and other places because the sewer systems have sewer, they have combined sewers. And when it rains a lot, they can't handle it and they have to push. And it's been going on for decades. Yeah. And until they separate them, and you know, it's gonna keep happening. But one of the cool things is Riverkeeper goes out and tests, and then you know not to go swimming or whatever. And it's, you know, it's just something that's always happened. And then I just wanted to point out that as an EMC, we can suggest to both our environmental and sustainability that we would like to do a wrap. We would help them write a memorializing resolution. They don't need to do it themselves. We are advisory to them. And we, if, you know, we just need to decide if we want to work on these things. So instead of them going, oh yeah, we're going to send a memorializing resolution, we can write it, ask them to do it, and be more of a, you know, doing our, helping by advising that that body. I mean, they're really good because there's such good people on that now, but I'm just bringing it up as a historic thing. And then of course, my CAC, we do ask, we either send resolution or send letters of support directly, or we ask our county council to do resolutions. And that's a way to, you know, let people know that, let our legislators know that we're interested. Yeah, anyway, so, and I just think it's so amazing with this rapid thing because we used to fight power lines, and now it seems like we're doing the opposite. Right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Beautiful. That's what I was. Sorry. I was still thinking about it.
No, I know. I was my head spinning too. Town of Saugerties, let me see, but the 18th of May, we planted a specimen border on our pollinator meadow that we seeded last fall. We bought over 100 native plants, pollinator support plants from the Catskill Native Nursery. I got together 13 volunteers, 3 paid municipal staff, and we knocked it out in 4 hours. And yeah, so it's really cool. And next steps are I'm designing some interpretive signage to have. And in a cool situation is right across the road from it is a rain garden that was done under a grant, and there's no interpretive material at all for that, so kind of down the road do that. So yeah, so we got our pollinator plants all in, and you mentioned the webinar or the action plan. So a couple of us from our CAC participated in the pollinator, what is it called, Climate Action Hudson Valley, and they had a webinar when they released that pollinator plan, which was excellent. It's just too bad we didn't know, you know, 2 years ago what we know today, but it's not too late. So I spent a huge amount of time cross-referencing what I know was going to come in the meadow, what we were going to put in the border, and then tried to make a point of having those plants that are especially the pollinator action plan identified 100 of the most important native pollinators to support and the associated plants. And they've done a phenomenal job because there's everything from urban tough areas to wet, shady areas and suggested plants. And they're working with Ernst Conservation Seed Company in Pennsylvania to make custom blends based on what your place is, what conditions you have. You know, is it an urban difficult area? Is it sunny and hot, whatever? And further, this fall, the Hudson Valley Seed Company is going to have custom mixes, a custom mix based on informed by the pollinator action plan. Those are going to be available.
Produced by whom again? I'm sorry.
It's Climate Action Hudson Valley.
Partners for Climate Action.
Yes.
Hudson Valley.
Partners for Climate Action. Yeah. Thank you. I can only remember what they're called. I know there's Hudson Valley Climate in there. But anyway, so those are coming. And I expect we're going to do overseeding this fall. It's got some bare area, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, so that is working. And I mentioned before that we had Phil brought in to extend a culvert, and they brought in Japanese knotweed. And, but we've been at it. So we're going to have a repair cafe on Saturday. Saturday's his first repair cafe. And yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Well, Vicki, Town of Ulster, we don't have a CAC. I seem to be the CAC. I'm only one person. But I took the solar mapping, and I'm in the process of doing my report, you know, for the solar mapping. And I've basically read the executive summary of the Town of Ulster comprehensive plan. It's a 300-page document, so I really did go through all of it. But I'm finding out with doing this report that they haven't really followed the comprehensive plan. They don't have a natural resource inventory, which I thought they did. So I went looking for it, and then found out that they didn't. So now I'm going to be going.
That's where the county one could help potentially.
I also want to just mention that Zena Woods, has everybody heard about the Zena Woods development? Okay, well, you know, the Zena Woods development now is going to the Town of Ulster property that they own, which is landlocked.
That's weird.
And so they're trying to get a road going through their town of Woodstock property, and the lawyer of the Town of Woodstock did a wonderful letter about how, you know, they can't really do a road if they don't have the same zoning that Woodstock has and everything. But anyway, I also want to tell you that these people, the developers, because of their investors, they are in it for the long haul. So this is something that's going to be fought for a number of years. Okay, they're ready to go through all the legal hoops and everything. So just be on, you know, because where they want to do this development is a very sensitive area and should never, ever be developed. But anyway.
Wow.
Just a side note to this that I became aware of, the developers approached the Ruby Rotten Gun Club.
Oh, yeah. We know
the possibility of putting a road through some of their property.
Huh.
Ruby Rotten Gun came back and said the limitations that would be caused by the development of that road are such that it would destroy significant portions of our usable hunting properties.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And therefore, no, under any circumstances. And an example that they used was that once the property was subdivided and buildings were placed on it, the 500-foot setback for the use of firearms would be such that it would cause significant portions of their property to become unusable by their membership.
Mm-hmm.
And I was absolutely amazed at their ability to come together and present the comprehensive review that they did to turn around and say no. I don't hunt with that organization, but that was a tremendous understanding of the additional difficulties that it would produce for them. And I applaud their answer in no uncertain terms. It was terrific.
It also reminds us that there are other groups out there in each of our towns that they can can help us and can be supportive of some of the measures that we try to put forth throughout our towns. And sometimes we forget about that. We try to do a solo thing and don't look around for other partners that can help us along the way.
Well, yeah, and the town of Ulster and the town of Woodstock really, you know, didn't think that they, you know, didn't know whether they would have a partner with the Ruby Riding Gun Club, but yes, because they have things in common. We want to preserve land. They want to preserve land for their livelihood, and we want to preserve land. You know, so there's a lot in common there.
Right.
And then Dave, reminder, we have Bob on the Zoom.
Yes. Is Sarah still up there?
I think she dropped off.
Okay. Bob, you have anything from up in your neck of the woods?
I do, very quickly, and thank you to Simon for and the town of Olive CAC. So I'm with the Shandaken CAC, as I think you know. In collaboration with the Olive CAC, as Simon mentioned, we had a really great heat pump and electric vehicle day. And we had about 7 different new electric vehicles and new and used, and car dealers came out and people were able to, you know, really kind of check things out. And there were alternating presentations from Tom Conrad on heat pumps and Steve Weir on electric vehicles. And both gentlemen are really, really good assets. We're putting a link on our website, the Town of Shandaken website, that really points to these services that the gentlemen offer in terms of really free coaching, that folks have questions on heat pumps and heat pump water heaters and electric vehicles. And they're both part of the New York for Clean Power organization. And so we're putting a link on our website. We already have pages on our website for our two community campaigns, the community solar and then the EV charging. And then while we're working tonight, I've been creating the page for the clean heating and cooling campaign. So we're doing more community outreach to try to help people understand, for example, on clean heating and cooling, that really every home in town qualifies for a free energy audit. And that's the first place to start. They can get free coaching, like I just mentioned, that there's community benefits. I think as some of the other folks were mentioning, you know, the first 5 people that buy heat pumps, the town gets $5,000. For the next 15 purchases, the town gets $10,000. For the next 30 purchases, the town gets an additional $20,000. So there's really, you know, some good resources to be had. And again, point you to the Shandaken.us website, Climate Smart tab, which is on the far right, and you can read about our campaigns. I think that's pretty much the news. Any questions for me?
No, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Always good to see you there. I mean, we don't see in person, but we do connect with you, so that's great.
Well, thank you. It's a long way to get to Kingston, and I'm really busy, and I broke my back last summer, and I haven't caught up yet.
Oh, well,
thank you.
Get better.
Okay. I'm good. Just behind.
Just a quick follow-up, Sean. I mentioned the mature tree issue last time on the property they want to put a solar farm. And so we had advised the planning board that they should get a certified arborist in there to evaluate the numbers of trees, the species of trees, the size of the trees, the condition of the trees, et cetera, et cetera. And the planning board went along with that. So it's just another little step in the way of this project.
Yeah.
Besides the fact we were out slopping through this is a very hydric soil. I mean, we were through the whole acreage on this thing. And they've got this beautiful vernal pool, which they don't want to touch the vernal pool, but they want to clear cut everything right up to the border of it. We suggested maybe that was a great idea either. Not the whole thing's not a good idea in this particular location, but that's okay.
Can I make a last announcement? I always remember things I forgot to tell everybody. The New York State Consolidated Funding application was announced. So there's all the grants available. The deadline is, as usual, the end of July. I don't remember the exact date. but it's always a difficult turnaround, especially for us at the county. If we need to get legislative resolutions routed, we have to route those a month in advance of the legislative session, basically. So there's always this kind of scramble to identify the funding opportunity, get enough information to put it in a resolution to get legislative approval in order to submit the grant application, because then you're committing the government, the county, to accepting the funds and providing the match. So anyway, just a reminder, there's lots of good opportunities with the Climate Smart Communities program. I noticed that that always traditionally have 50% local match required, which I think is really prohibitive for a lot of the local municipalities, especially. And that's reduced to 20% for projects in disadvantaged community census tracts. So I would definitely take a look at that. There's also some Hudson River Estuary program grants open that I don't think are necessarily CFA, but yeah, there's some good ones. And then water quality improvement program, the non-agricultural, non-point source pollution, which has to do with the stormwater mapping and compliance. So a lot of good stuff in there in case anyone has some free time and want to bring that to the attention of your town. So
I have one other note, and it's cautionary. There's a new asphalt plant that was built on 28 in the town of Kingston. The Walker property. Buzzy died, his wife got the property, and she has sold it to somebody that put an asphalt plant in. A lot of questions have come up relative to odors and the effect of odors on those people that are using